Welcome to today's deep dive. We are so glad you could join us. Today, we're exploring a really wild paradox.
Yeah, it's a fascinating one.
Right. We're looking at this crazy scenario where historic preservation is actually harming a community.
Exactly. It completely defies how we usually think about, you know, protecting our cities.
Yeah. And to really get into this, we are using an incredibly detailed source. It's the HGM 587 Lincoln Heights Jail-PDC Audit and Design Proposal.
It is basically a masterclass in urban planning gone wrong.
It really is. So I want you to just picture this. Imagine a massive, like completely graffiti-covered, decaying jail sitting on almost 2 acres of prime Los Angeles real estate.
It's just massive.
Yeah, it's a 1.7-acre parcel right on North Avenue 19, and it's backing up directly against the LA River. The yards are totally cracked. The windows are all boarded up.
In complete eyesore.
An absolute eyesore. And a documented physical hazard, right? It's been abandoned for decades. So, okay, let's unpack this. Because the core mystery we need to solve today is why this crumbling, vacant building is practically untouchable.
What's fascinating here is that the barrier isn't structural at all. It's, well, it's entirely bureaucratic.
Really? Just paperwork?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Back in November of 1993, this facility was designated as a historic cultural monument. Or an HCM.
Okay, an HCM. Usually that's a good thing, right?
Yeah.
Like saving a beautiful theater or something.
Right. The intention is to freeze a building in time because it has, you know, immense cultural or architectural value. But this audit points out that this specific designation is not shielding a thriving piece of history.
It's doing the opposite.
Yeah, it's acting as a legal barricade. The source actually categorizes it as a blocking redevelopment case.
Wow.
Meaning the historic status is actively keeping this 1.7-acre parcel from being put to a higher use. It's blocking any kind of neighborhood redevelopment.
It's almost like, I mean, it's like putting a museum-grade glass display case over a radioactive spill, you know?
That's a very good way to put it.
Like, sure, you're preserving the physical site, but you're also locking all that damage into the neighborhood so nobody can clean it up.
Exactly. And to really grasp how bad this is, we have to look at the hard data from the audit. They use this thing called the HCM 1200 audit rubric.
The HCM 1200, right.
Yeah. It translates the visual ugliness of the building into measurable statistical impacts on the surrounding residents.
Right. Moving from just looking bad to actually causing harm. So what do the numbers say?
It's pretty stark. They have a metric called the externality load. And the audit shows this single vacant jail generated 12 code complaints in just a 24-month period.
Wait, 12? Let me stop you there. Because, you know, code complaints can sound like just minor bureaucratic paperwork to some people.
Oh, it's not.
Right. What does that actually mean for the people living across the street?
Well, it means a constant physical drain on city resources and a persistent degradation of their immediate environment.
Like trash and stuff.
Yeah, illegal dumping, structural hazards, severe blight, or, you know, unpermitted entry people breaking in.
Jeez.
Every single time one of those 12 complaints is filed, the city has to send out inspectors. Or sometimes police, fire personnel, sanitation crews. It requires a physical response every time.
And the burden of that decay, it's not falling on a wealthy neighborhood.
Right.
Like, they don't have the resources to buffer themselves.
No, not at all.
Because the audit looks at neighborhood health. And the median household income for this specific census tract is just $38,000.
Which is incredibly low for that area.
It really is. So this low-income community is just forced to absorb all the negative day-to-day impacts of this massive abandoned site.
Right. They're the involuntary shock absorbers here.
Mm.
And meanwhile, the rubric shows the building scores a 0 out of 10 for subsidy efficiency.
Okay. Subsidy efficiency. That sounds like heavy accounting jargon. Break that down for us. What does a 0 actually mean in the real world?
Basically, it means the building is a financial black hole. Usually historic buildings survive because they tap into economic engines.
Right. Like grants and stuff.
Yeah. Like the Mills Act, which is a state program that gives big property tax relief to owners who restore historic places, or federal historic tax credits.
Oh, right. Incentives for developers.
Exactly. But the Lincoln Heights Jail uses none of that. Zero preservation funding, zero tax revenue, zero commercial income.
It's just sitting there. But wait, I remember the audit does mention one statistic that seems to point toward, like, public interest.
The Wikipedia thing.
Yeah. It says the jail gets over 14,446 Wikipedia page views a year. So doesn't that mean people actually care about it? Like, it has some tourist currency.
The expert auditors address that exact point. They categorize that web traffic strictly as morbid curiosity.
Morbid curiosity. Wow.
Right. It's a crucial distinction. We have to separate digital rubbernecking from actual destination visitation.
Because nobody is actually going there.
Exactly. Nobody is booking a flight to LA to take a walking tour of a toxic abandoned jail. They're Googling it because it's creepy and infamous. That digital curiosity does absolutely nothing to support the local economy.
So it's basically a zombie. I mean, technically alive on paper, but totally dead and decaying in reality.
That's exactly what it is.
If the audit calls it just a stripped institutional masonry building by a low prominence designer, why are we saving it? Does every old civic building just get a free pass for existing?
Well, the argument keeping it on the registry is what preservationists call a civic typological argument.
Civic typological, meaning what?
Meaning it represents a specific era of municipal correctional construction. It shows how LA built jails a century ago.
Okay, but surely this isn't the only surviving example of that architecture in the entire city.
Far from it. LA already has comparable and frankly way better preserved examples.
Like what?
Like portions of the original Hall of Justice downtown, or early municipal buildings in Boyle Heights. And the big difference is those buildings are in active reuse.
They're actually doing something.
Right. They've been integrated back into the city. Which raises an important question. What exactly is the HCM status protecting here?
Yeah, if we have better examples already.
Exactly. The audit states plainly that without that piece of paper, this jail would have been demolished a long time ago.
Okay, but this brings up a really logical follow-up. If the historical value is weak and it's sitting on incredibly valuable land, I mean, the audit says this is a transit priority area, right? Mm. Eligible for TOC Tier 3 density bonuses.
Yeah, highly valuable land.
So translate that for a second. The city desperately wants housing near bus routes and trains, so they give bonuses allowing developers to build way taller than normal zoning allows.
Right, massive density bonuses.
So if it's that valuable, why hasn't some developer just bought it, fought the historical commission, knocked it down, and built apartments?
And that takes us right into the hidden trap of the site. It's not just bureaucracy. The audit classifies this as a type 1 vacancy.
A type 1 vacancy, okay.
Which means commercial and civic obsolescence, coupled with what they call a contamination overhang.
Contamination overhang. Is that just urban planner speak for, like, we found a little bit of lead paint? Or is it a real hazard?
Oh, it's a massive hazard.
Yeah.
It fundamentally alters the math for the whole site. Remember, this jail was decommissioned around 1965.
Okay.
It backs right onto the LA River.
Yeah.
You have a century of heavy correctional use.
Mm.
The audit shows that kind of sustained use leaves a severe toxic legacy. Lead paint, friable asbestos, and huge soil contamination.
Oh, wow. So my display case analogy earlier was spot on. The HCM designation is literally a historical shield hiding a toxic core.
Literally.
So any developer looking at this isn't just pricing out demolition costs. They are looking at a full-blown environmental hazmat scene.
Precisely. The risk is astronomical. The site has a 73% probability of type 1 contamination, and it sits in the 98th percentile of the CalEnviroScreen screen.
Wait, the 98th percentile? For those who don't know, CalEnviroScreen screen is California's mapping tool that measures how burdened a community is by pollution, right? So 98th percentile means?
It means this neighborhood is one of the most heavily polluted and vulnerable locations in the entire state.
That is heartbreaking.
It is. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, the audit argues the city can't just call this blocking redevelopment and walk away. They have to flag it as contamination encumbered.
Because private money alone is never going to be enough to fix it.
The math just doesn't work.
Yeah.
Environmental remediation hazmat suits, soil removal, specialized disposal. It would entirely swallow any profit margin from building housing there.
Right.
The audit stresses you need a massive public-private remediation partnership, integrating databases like DTSC, EnviroStore, and the Cortese List.
And the Cortese List, that's basically the state's master ledger of worst-case hazardous waste sites, right?
Exactly.
So a developer has to navigate a labyrinth of state environmental agencies before they can even think about pouring concrete.
Right. The historical designation is the first lock on the door, but the contamination is the deadbolt.
Okay, so to recap this grim reality, we have a contaminated, redundant, decaying jail draining city resources, actively burdening a low-income neighborhood, and it's protected by a 1993 bureaucratic designation.
Very bleak.
It is remarkably bleak. But what I love about this source is that it doesn't just stop at diagnosing the disease. It pivots into these futuristic architectural visions for what this 1.7-acre parcel could actually become.
Yeah, if they can delist it and clean it up.
Exactly.
The potential is staggering because of that TOC Tier 3 density bonus. Both proposals aim to yield roughly 200 to 400 housing units.
And importantly, a lot of those would be deed-restricted affordable units, right?
Yes, which is huge for a neighborhood starved of public investment.
Definitely. And before we get into the two proposals, there's this really clever architectural compromise they both share.
Oh, saving the facade.
Yeah. They don't erase the history entirely. They propose saving just the south-facing jail facade and using it as a civic threshold.
Right, an entry portal.
Rather than a fenced-off ruin.
It's an elegant way to handle urban memory. You keep a fragment of the past to frame the entry, but you completely revolutionize the environment behind it.
Okay, so let's look at the proposals. Proposal one is the rectilinear form. This one is basically a 4 to 6 story stepped ziggurat block.
Right, a stepped ziggurat. It's a very efficient design. It yields about 280 units and dedicating 40% of those as affordable housing.
Which is fantastic. Mm-hmm. But it also tackles the area's daily needs. Because right now, that census tract is a grocery desert.
Yeah, no fresh food nearby.
So the ground floor of the ziggurat tackles that directly. Groceries, childcare, community health. And it has a north plaza with step terraces down to the river.
It's highly functional.
Yeah.
And it uses just 0.5 parking spaces per unit.
Half a parking space per apartment, which I know some people hear that and panic about street parking.
Oh, sure.
But this is a transit priority area. The whole point is to build housing for people using the buses and trains, right? Building giant parking garages just wastes space and money.
Exactly. It plays very safely by the familiar modern zoning rules.
It does. But here's where it gets really interesting. Let's talk about Proposal 2.
The sphere.
Yes, the sphere-based form. When I read the audit, it felt like I was looking at a sci-fi terrarium.
It's a radical departure.
An urban sphere plate. It's a massive half-dome envelope, 150 feet in radius. It maximizes density to hold about 320 units.
And it divides the interior into 8 radial wedges, like pie slices.
Right. 6 for housing, 1 for a grocery, 1 for a restaurant. It even caps internal speeds at 15 miles per hour for bikes. But I have to push back here.
Sure.
Is a giant, futuristic half dome really going to fit into this neighborhood better than a standard apartment block? It sounds kind of alien.
It's a totally valid critique.
Hmm.
But the audit breaks down the mechanics, and the sphere actually solves problems the ziggurat can't.
Like what?
First, the visual massing. A standard step block can feel like a massive wall looming over Franklin Avenue.
Oh, I see. But a dome curves way.
Exactly. It recedes as it gets taller, so it feels less oppressive to pedestrians.
That makes sense.
Second is the lighting and ventilation. The top of the sphere has a 60-foot central aperture.
Just a giant hole in the roof. How does that help?
It acts as a massive thermal chimney. Hot air rises, escapes out the 60-foot oculus, and creates a vacuum that pulls fresh, cool air in from the ground level.
Wow.
It pulls daylight deep inside and ventilates the whole structure naturally without relying on massive air conditioning units.
That is incredible engineering.
It is. But the third advantage is the most important. It creates a massive, publicly accessible interior environment.
For a neighborhood that really lacks park space.
Right. They call it the small kitchen housing model.
Let's explain that because it's a cool concept. It means the private apartments are more compact, maybe smaller kitchens. But in exchange, you get this huge communal plaza right outside your door.
Exactly. It encourages interaction. And that save jail facade becomes a majestic entrance to this entirely new, light-filled hub.
It takes a space designed to be punitive and dark and completely inverts it into something open and communal.
That's the ultimate promise of adaptive reuse.
So what does this all mean for you? If you're listening right now, why should you care about an abandoned jail in LA?
It's a great question.
I think it comes down to how cities survive. Urban design isn't just about building shiny new things. It's about making hard choices about what we have to let go of for the sake of neighborhood health.
That tension is exactly why this audit was commissioned. And their immediate recommendation is very pragmatic.
Right, the call to action.
The city must immediately field validate the structural condition of the jail.
Get engineers in there to see if it can even be reused.
Yes. And if it can't be safely reused at a density that supports the parcel, the Cultural Heritage Commission has to initiate a delisting review with public input.
Which is exactly the data this conversation has been missing for 30 years.
Exactly.
But, you know, I want to leave you with one final provocative thought today. Something not in the text, but it really nagged at me.
About the morbid curiosity.
Yeah. People are fascinated by the dark history of that site. So think about this. If we do tear down those physical walls to build a beautiful futuristic sphere, do the ghosts of that correctional history just vanish?
That's a heavy question.
Does the invisible trauma of a century-old jail linger in the neighborhood's memory long after the asbestos is scrubbed from the soil?
Or does the new community finally let it heal?
Exactly. Something to think about the next time you walk past a boarded-up historic building. What is it really protecting? Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive.